welcome to a half hour of Mind Webs. Short stories from the worlds of speculative fiction. This story comes from the 12th series of the best from fantasy and science fiction, edited by Avram Davidson. The story's title is The Garden of Time by J.G. Ballard. Toward evening, when the great shadow of the Palladian villa filled the terrace, Count Axel left his library and walked down the wide rococo steps among the thyme flowers. A tall, imperious figure in a black velvet jacket, a gold tie-pin glinting below his George V beard, cane held stiffly in a white-gloved hand, the Count surveyed the exquisite crystal flowers without emotion, listening to the sounds of his wife's harpsichord as she played a Mozart rondo in the music room. It echoed and vibrated through the translucent petals. The garden of the villa extended for some 200 yards below the terrace, sloping down to a miniature lake spanned by a white bridge, a slender pavilion on the opposite bank. Axel rarely ventured as far as the lake. Most of the thyme flowers grew in a small grove just below the terrace, sheltered by a high wall which encircled the estate. From the terrace he could see over the wall to the plain beyond, a continuous expanse of open ground that rolled in great swells to the horizon, where it rose slightly before finally dipping from sight. The plain surrounded the house on all sides, its drab emptiness emphasizing the seclusion and mellowed magnificence of the villa. Here in the garden, the air seemed brighter, the sun warmer, while the plain was always dull and remote. As was his custom before beginning his regular evening stroll, Count Axel looked out across the plain to the final rise, where the horizon was illuminated like a distant stage by the fading sun. As the Mozart chimed delicately around him, flowing from his wife's graceful hands, he saw that the advance columns of an enormous army were moving slowly over the horizon. At first glance, the long ranks seemed to be progressing in orderly lines, but on closer inspection it was apparent that, like the obscured detail of a Goya landscape, the army was composed of a vast, confused throng of people, men and women, interspersed with a few soldiers in ragged uniforms, pressing forward in a disorganized tide. Some labored under heavy loads suspended from crude yokes around their necks. Others struggled with cumbersome wooden carts, their hands wrenching at the wheel spokes. A few trudged on alone, but all moved on at the same pace, bowed backs illuminated in the fleeting sun. The advancing throng was almost too far away to be visible, but even as Axel watched, his expression aloof yet observant, it came perceptibly nearer, the vanguard of an immense rabble appearing from below the horizon. At last, as the daylight began to fade, the front edge of the throng reached the crest of the first swell below the horizon, and Axel turned from the terrace and walked down among the thyme flowers. The flowers grew to a height of about 6 feet, their slender stems like rods of glass, bearing a dozen leaves, the once transparent fronds frosted by the fossilized veins. At the peak of each stem was the thyme flower, the size of a goblet, the opaque outer petals enclosing the crystal heart. Their diamond brilliance contained a thousand faces, the crystal seeming to drain the air of its light and motion. As the flowers swayed slightly in the evening air, they glowed like flame-tipped spears. Many of the stems no longer bore flowers, and Axel examined them all carefully, a note of hope now and then crossing his mind as he searched for any further buds. Finally, he selected a large flower on the stem nearest the wall, removed his gloves, and with his strong fingers snapped it off. As he carried the flower back into the terrace, it began to sparkle and deliquesce, the light trapped within the core at last released. Gradually, the crystal dissolved, only the outer petals remaining intact, and the air around Axel became bright and vivid, charged with slanting rays that flared away into the waning sunlight. Strange shifts momentarily transformed the evening, subtly altering its dimensions of time and space. The darkened portico of the house, its patina of age stripped away, loomed with a curious spectral whiteness, as if suddenly remembered in a dream. Raising his head, Axel peered over the wall again. Only the furthest rim of the horizon was lit by the sun, and the great throng, which before had stretched almost a quarter of the way across the plain, had now receded to the horizon, the entire concourse abruptly flung back in a reversal of time, now appearing to be stationary. The flower in Axel's hand had shrunk to the size of a glass thimble, the petals contracting around the vanishing core. A faint sparkle flickered from the center and extinguished itself, and Axel felt the flower melt like an ice-cold bead of dew in his hand. Dusk closed across the house, sweeping its long shadows over the plain, the horizon merging into the sky. The harpsichord was silent, and the thyme flowers, no longer reflecting its music, stood motionlessly like an embalmed forest. For a few minutes, Axel looked down at them, counting the flowers which remained, then greeted his wife as she crossed the terrace, her brocade evening dress rustling over the ornamental tiles.
What a beautiful evening, Axel.
She spoke feelingly, as if she were thanking her husband personally for the great ornate shadow across the lawn and the dark, brilliant air. Her face was serene and intelligent. Her hair, swept back behind her head into a jeweled clasp, touched with silver. She wore her dress low across her breast, revealing a long, slender neck and high chin. Axel surveyed her with fond pride. He gave her his arm, and together they walked down the steps into the garden.
One of the longest evenings this summer. I picked the perfect flower, my dear, a jewel. With luck, it should last us for several days.
A frown touched his brow, and he glanced involuntarily at the wall.
Each time now, they seem to come nearer.
His wife smiled at him encouragingly and held his arm more tightly. Both of them knew that the garden was dying. Three evenings later, as he had estimated, though sooner than he secretly hoped, Count Axel plucked another flower from the thyme garden. When he first looked over the wall, the approaching rabble filled the distant half of the plain, stretching across the horizon in an unbroken mass. He thought he could hear the low, fragmentary sounds of voices carried across the empty air, a sullen murmur punctuated by cries and shouts. But quickly he told himself that he had imagined them. Luckily, his wife was at her harpsichord, and the rich contrapuntal patterns of a Bach fugue cascaded lightly across the terrace, masking the other noises. Between the house and the horizon, the plain was divided into four huge swells, the crest of each one clearly visible in the slanting light. Axel had promised himself that he would never count them, but the number was too small to remain unobserved, particularly when it so obviously marked the progress of the advancing army. By now, the forward line had passed the first crest and was well on its way to the second. The main bulk of the throng pressed behind it, hiding the crest and the even vaster concourse spreading from the horizon. Looking to left and right of the central body, Axel could see the apparently limitless extent of the army. What had seemed at first to be the central mass was no more than a minor advance guard, one of many similar arms reaching across the plain. The true center had not yet emerged, but from the rate of extension, Axel estimated that when it finally reached the plain, it would completely cover every foot of ground. Axel searched for any large vehicles or machines, but all was amorphous and uncoordinated as ever. There were no banners, no flags, no mascots or pike-bearers. Heads bowed, the multitude pressed on, unaware of the sky. Suddenly, just before Axel turned away, the forward edge of the throng appeared on top of the second crest and swarmed down across the plain. What astounded Axel was the incredible distance it had covered while out of sight. The figures were now twice the size, each one clearly within sight. Quickly, Axel stepped from the terrace, selected a thyme flower from the garden, and tore it from the stem. As it released its compacted light, he returned to the terrace. When the flower had shrunk to a frozen pearl in his palm, he looked out at the plain. With relief, saw that the army had retreated to the horizon again. Then he realized that the horizon was much nearer than previously, and that what he assumed to be the horizon was the first crest. When he joined the Countess on their evening walk, he told her nothing of what had gone before, but she could see behind his casual unconcern and did what she could to dispel his worry. Walking down the steps, the Countess pointed to the thyme garden.
What a wonderful display, Axel. There are so many flowers still.
Axel nodded, smiling to himself at his wife's attempt to reassure him. Her use of still had revealed her own unconscious anticipation of the end. In fact, a mere dozen flowers remained of the many hundred that had grown in the garden, and several of these were little more than buds. Only three or four were fully grown. As they walked down to the lake, the Countess's dress rustling across the cool turf, he tried to decide whether to pick the larger flowers first or leave them to the end. Strictly, it would be better to give the smaller flowers additional time to grow and mature, and this advantage would be lost if he retained the larger flowers to the end, as he wished to do for the final repulse. However, he realized that it mattered little either way. The garden would soon die, and the smaller flowers required far longer than he could give them to accumulate their compressed cores of time. During his entire lifetime, he had failed to notice a single evidence of growth among the flowers. The larger blooms had always been mature, and none of the buds had shown the slightest development. Crossing the lake, he and his wife looked down at their reflections in the still black water. Shielded by the pavilion on one side and the high garden wall on the other, the villa in the distance, Axel felt composed and secure. The plain with its encroaching multitude, a nightmare from which he had safely awakened. He put one arm around his wife's smooth waist and pressed her affectionately to his shoulder, realizing that he had not embraced her for several years, though their lives together had been timeless, and he could remember as if yesterday when he first brought her to live in the villa.
Axel, before the garden dies, may I pick the last flower?
Understanding her request, the Count nodded slowly. one by one over the succeeding evenings, the Count picked the remaining flowers, leaving a single small bud which grew just below the terrace for his wife. He took the flowers at random, refusing to count or ration them, plucking two or three of the smaller buds at the same time when necessary. The approaching horde had now reached the second and third crests, a vast concourse of laboring humanity that blotted out the horizon. From the terrace, Axel could see clearly the shuffling, straining ranks moving down into the hollow towards the final crests, and occasionally the sounds of their voices carried across to him, interspersed with cries of anger and the cracking of whips. The wooden carts lurched from side to side on tilting wheels, their drivers struggling to control them. As far as Axel could tell, not a single member of the throng was aware of its overall direction. Rather, each one blindly moved forward across the ground, directly below the heels of the person in front of him. The only unity was that of the cumulative compass. Pointlessly, Axel hoped that the true center, far below the horizon, might be moving in a different direction, and that gradually the multitude would alter course, swing away from the villa, and recede from the plain like a turning tide. On the last evening but one, as he plucked the thyme flower, the forward edge of the rabble had reached the third crest and was swarming past it. While he waited for the countess, Axel looked down at the two flowers left, both small buds which would carry them back through only a few minutes of the next evening. The glass stems of the dead flowers reared up stiffly into the air, but the whole garden had lost its bloom. Axel passed the next morning quietly in his library, sealing the rarer of his manuscripts into the glass-top cases between the galleries. He walked slowly down the portrait corridor, polishing each of the pictures carefully, then tidied his desk and locked the door behind him. During the afternoon, he busied himself in the drawing rooms, unobtrusively assisting his wife as she cleaned their ornaments and straightened the vases and busts. By evening, as the sun fell behind the house, they were both tired and dusty, and neither had spoken to the other all day. When his wife moved toward the music room, Axel called her back.
Tonight, we'll pick the flowers together, my dear. One for each of us.
He peered only briefly over the wall. They could hear, less than half a mile away, the great, dull roar of the ragged army, the ring of iron and lash pressing on towards the house. Quickly, Axel plucked his flower, a bud no bigger than a sapphire. As it flickered softly, the tumult outside momentarily receded and then began to gather again. Shutting his ears to the clamor, Axel looked around at the villa, counting the six columns in the portico, then gazed out across the lawn at the silver disk of the lake, its bowl reflecting the last evening light, and at the shadows moving between the tall trees lengthening across the crisp turf. He lingered over the bridge where he and his wife had stood arm in arm for so many summers.
Axel!
The tumult outside roared into the air. A thousand voices bellowed only 20 or 30 yards away. A stone flew over the wall and landed among the thyme flowers, snapping several of the brittle stems. The countess ran towards him as a further barrage rattled along the wall. Then a heavy tile whirled through the air over their heads and crashed into one of the conservatory windows.
Axel!
He put his arms around her, straightening his silk cravat when her shoulder brushed it between his lapels.
Quickly, my dear, the last flower.
He led her down the steps and through the garden. Taking the stem between her jeweled fingers, she snapped it cleanly and cradled it within her palms. For a moment, the tumult lessened slightly, and Axel collected himself. In the vivid light sparkling from the flower, he saw his wife's white, frightened eyes.
Hold it as long as you can, my dear, until the last grain dies.
Together, they stood on the terrace, the Countess clasping the brilliant dying jewel, the air closing in upon them as the voices outside mounted again. The mob was battering at the heavy iron gates, and the whole villa shook with the massive impact. While the final glimmer of light sped away, the Countess raised her palms to the air as if releasing an invisible bird. Then, in a final access of courage, put her hands in her husband's, her smile as radiant as the vanished flower.
Oh, Axel!
Like a sword, the darkness swooped down across it. Heaving and swearing, the outer edge of the mob reached the knee-high remains of the wall enclosing the ruined estate, hauled their carts over it and along the dry ruts of what had once been an ornate drive. The ruin, formerly a spacious villa, barely interrupted the ceaseless tide of humanity. The lake was empty, fallen trees rotting at its bottom, the old bridge rusting into it. Weeds flourished among the long grass and the lawn, overrunning the ornamental pathways and carved stone screens. Much of the terrace had crumbled, and the main section of the mob cut straight across the lawn, bypassing the gutted villa, but one or two of the more curious climbed up and searched among the shell. The doors had rotted from their hinges, and the floors had fallen through. In the music room, an ancient harpsichord had been chopped into firewood, but a few keys still lay among the dust. All the books had been toppled from the shelves in the library. The canvases had been slashed, and gilt frames littered the floor. As the main body of the mob reached the house, it began to cross the wall at all points along its length. Jostled together, the people stumbled into the dry lake, swarmed over the terrace, pressed through the house towards the open doors on the north side. One area alone withstood the endless wave. Just below the terrace, between the wrecked balcony and the wall, there was a dense 6-foot-high growth of heavy thorn bushes. The barbed foliage formed an impenetrable mass, and the people passing stepped around it carefully, noticing the belladonna entwined among the branches. Most of them were too busy finding their footing among the upturned flagstones to look up into the center of the thorn bushes, where two stone statues stood side by side, gazing out over the grounds from their protected vantage point. The larger of the figures was the effigy of a bearded man in a high-colored jacket, a cane under one arm. Beside him was a woman in an elaborate full-skirted dress, her slim, serene face unmarked by the wind and rain. In her left hand, she lightly clasped a single rose, the delicately formed petals so thin as to be almost transparent. As the sun died away behind the house, a single ray of light glanced through a shattered cornice and struck the rose, reflected off the whorl of petals onto the statues, lighting up the gray stone so that for a fleeting moment it was indistinguishable from the long vanished flesh of the statues' originals. This time was The Garden of Time by J.G. Ballard. It appears in the book edited by Avram Davidson, The Best from Fantasy and Science Fiction, 12th Series. This is Michael Hansen speaking. Technical production for Mindwebs by Leslie Hilsenhoff.